this week, U.S. equities continued to capture the bulls' imagination. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with you on this August 10th show with another two guest interviews, one encore with John Williams and another with a brand new guest. In this Season 13, Episode 656 edition, stocks remain strong and the metals are under some pressure. What's going on in these markets? Well, joining me with their take, Peter Hugg makes his debut appearance on the show. Director of Kitco, the precious metals division, says negativity in the retail gold market and silver has reached such levels that from a contrarian view, they're practically giving the stuff away. He outlines an effective strategy for helping his clients and our listeners reap big rewards, as well as two unique precious metals that few people have heard of. And then an encore with John Williams from ShadowStats. He's looking for explosive moves in the precious metals and says, again, inflation vastly understated. Consumers are being robbed at a record clip. And frankly, anyone, no matter what economic level you find your household at, can probably relate to his comments. Even former Fed heads Ben Bernanke and Sir Alan Greenspan have instructed their chauffeurs to stop buying premium. They're dropping down to 89-octane regular gas for the former Fed head, so we know something must be amiss here. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. It may be early next week before you can hear his comments at the end of the show, because we lost our phone and our internet and email and you name it. Had an unexpected outage, and we'd like for you to record your questions and comments on our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. Please jot it down or plug it right into your phone, followed by extension number 514049. That's easy enough, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. And we're also running a Gold Seek Radio promotion this week. If you sign up for any level of our subscriptions, the monthly, the annual, 5-year, or 10-year, you will receive your own crypto asset. This is a neat asset class on the test net, but if it were on the real net, it would be worth from $500 to several $1,000 per asset, and each level receives a higher quality, up to a bronze level asset. These are really neat. I think you'll be quite impressed. We're also giving 10 testnet ETH to each subscriber and up to 100 ETH if you go 5 or 10 year subscriptions. So you'll want to act quickly. I can't promise this promotion will last long. It's first come, first serve. So just sign up or send me a message at gsr@hughes.net and I can help you. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies persisted over the precious metals sector as investors turned to the U.S. dollar on growing international currency chaos. At the time of this recording, around 4 p.m. Eastern Friday, gold ended the week off about $35, ending at $1,184, just shy of that $1,200 support. Silver gave back 58 cents at $1,473 with strong support. And the XAU shares, though, gave back stunning 11%, down $8 at $65.94. Black gold gave back just 2, finishing around $65.50, and the Bitcoin GBTC ETF was off 72 cents, about 7.6%, finishing at $8.88. GoldSeek continues to monitor Halo's tokens and the Halo project with strong interest. Turning to the top story moving the markets, gold came under pressure amid the U.S. dollar index rally, which touched a 14-month record this week on the heels of hawkish Federal Reserve rate hikes and rhetoric that helped turn investors to U.S. equities. Plus, continued financial crisis issues in Turkey and chaos with the Turkish lira had investors turning to the short-term safe haven of the U.S. dollar as fears of a currency pandemic continue to be whispered around trading desks. A bevy of economic reports further buoyed the greenback, including retail sales, productivity, regional manufacturing, all suggesting solid odds of a rate hike at the September-December meetings, as well as early next year at the Fed Funds Futures at the St. Louis Fed website. Elsewhere, one wonders if investors are missing the macroeconomic theme of imminent inflation, with U.S. government debt now having tripled since 2007, while federal spending has resulted in a budget deficit and even a crisis. The Congressional Budget Office predicts we'll reach $1 trillion by 2020, according to one media source. Traditionally, such debt and spending plus rate hikes represent the perfect recipe for runaway inflation circa the 1970s, where we saw the precious metals move many-fold higher. Bottom line, precious metals. Well, clearly the strong U.S. dollar continues to plague the sector. The technical picture, however, does suggest a washout, a capitulation this week or last week, meaning a bottom could soon be in place. Plus, we have that holiday buying season, which traditionally helps put a floor under the XAU and the metals. Solid head and shoulders pattern, similar to the 2009 bottom, which could indicate a strong rally in the coming months. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies appeared over the U.S. equities markets as global funds continued to pour in on more solid economic reports. At the time of this recording, around 4 p.m. Friday, the Dow Jones added to last week's gains an impressive 356 points, 1.4%, at 25,670, above that psychological support of 25,000. The S&P 500 also tacked on 17 at 2850, while the NASDAQ, though, bucked the trend down 23 points at 78.16, a much-needed rest following weeks of stellar gains. The top story impacting the markets and U.S. equities, stocks roared back for the most part on news that the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan, while talking hawkish, don't really seem likely to pull the trigger on higher rates or curtailing QT operations for the time being, while their Fed compadres still have plans to raise rates at least 3 to 4 more times, while stronger dollar does increase the cost of U.S. goods, at least on a relative basis, making them seem less affordable. It does improve the relative payouts of U.S. dividends and dividend shares, and this thing helps to continue to flood our indices with global funds as investors worldwide seek U.S. stock dividends in our reserve currency. U.S. shares, bottom line. As anticipated in the last report, the technical position combined with insatiable demand for shares helped most equities indexes to rebound sharply, roaring back, and the 7-indicator greed and fear index pendulum is still in the relatively greedy category, which is viewed really as a neutral sign right now. I don't see any major concerns on the horizon and possibly further gains in the months ahead. Coming up after the break, more Goldseek. Pleasure to welcome Peter Hug, director of Kitco's Precious Metals Division. He develops better investment strategies for Kitco customers. Welcome, Peter Hug.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Nice to be here.
Reading through some of your latest articles online, and clearly you've noted this trend of increased purchases by ETFs. This is just essentially funds easy to access. You think this could be a good sign that they see something on the horizon?
Well, yeah, we're sort of monitoring this market. There's been an anomaly in this market that I haven't seen in the 40-odd years that I've been in the business. Generally, when you have markets that trend higher, you tend to have retail buying into strength. What we've seen over the past couple of years is that the retail market has actually been selling into strength. They're not believing in the rally, which turns out that they made the right guess on the market. So when gold was over $1,300 and couldn't get through that critical level at 1365, which everybody was looking for at the beginning of this year and a number of occasions over the past 2 years where it hit that level, retail has now started to take money off the table. And as the market came lower, generally when you have a market that's dropping, retail does not sell into weakness. But they've also been selling into weakness. They've just literally been abandoning the market, which indicates to me that we might be getting to a capitulation where people are sort of throwing out the baby with the bathwater and giving up on precious metals as a viable investment to hold in their portfolio. That generally indicates to me we're getting close to a bottom.
Okay, so you're seeing sort of a capitulation moment where investors are just tired. They're saying, hey, wait a minute, look at Google, look at Microsoft, look at some of these high flyers. Technology, for the most part, continues to make these amazing new highs, 50% above the year 2000 peak. Well, history tends to show us that financial conditions tend to swing like a pendulum, and maybe we've overdone it to the negative side here on precious metals. Give us an idea of some of the opportunities you see there, and maybe touch on the insurance aspects.
I did sort of a survey about 3 years ago. I looked sort of back at the history of sort of my history in this business, and I looked back specifically in the 79-80 period when we had the first what people now term as the gold rush, when gold went from roughly about $100 an ounce to $850, and silver ran from about $4 up to $50. That was repeated for silver between the 2008-2011 cycle, and obviously gold went much higher than $850 in 2008-2011 cycle, going all the way to 19 and a quarter. Sort of looked in the mirror and I said, let's just compare then and now. And, you know, when I looked at the products that were available in 79-80 and compared them to what products are available now, there's really very little difference in what investors can invest in precious metals, other than back in 79-80, there weren't computers and there weren't ETFs. But other than that, there were pretty much all the products that were offered back then are offered now. Yeah, you can, obviously, the mining shares, the mutual funds, physical metals, trading accounts, certificates, paper trading, futures, options, they were all available back in 79-80. And then I tried to recall what kind of speeches I gave in the conferences back in the good old days when Jim Blanchard was alive and he had the gold conference in New Orleans. Looked at what the sort of the pundits then said and what the investors asked me. You know, they asked me the same questions then that they ask me now. And you know, the primary question is, should I buy gold? You know, really, that's not a question just to answer by saying yes or no. You really need to sort of dig a little deeper and find out what the motivation is for the client buying gold. Like, are you buying gold for capital gains purposes? Are you buying it because you think the financial system is going to totally collapse and you're looking for gold as sort of a refuge when the fiat currency system in the world collapses? Are you looking for capital gains in that context? Are you a trader? So, you know, depending on how that question is answered, you can then give clients better advice as to sort of what vehicles to look at when they're looking at precious metals, whether they should be buying physical and taking delivery, whether they should be looking for geographical diversification and holding some of their gold outside of the United States because they don't trust the government or they don't trust the financial system. Should they be looking at futures or options because they can get better leverage on their returns? And again, depending on how those questions are answered, you can then give sort of a better concept of how to hold gold. So if we go into the concept of insurance, which is sort of my second group of investors, which I call sort of the conservative class, that want to hold a percentage of their portfolio in gold as a hedge in case anything happens, maybe not as severe as 2008, 2011, but maybe something like 8% inflation or some kind of geopolitical event that they're protecting against. So they buy this gold as an insurance position. Unfortunately, the pundits that suggest that never sort of complete the thought. They say buy 10% of your position in gold as an insurance position, and they end the sentence there. What you need to add to that sentence is gold is not an be-all where, you know, it's not just the magic elixir for everything that could go wrong in the world. So if you come up with a concept that you want to hold 10% of your portfolio in gold, you have to treat gold the same way you would treat Apple stock, same way you would treat bonds, same way you would treat any other product in your portfolio. In that context, you need to rebalance your portfolio. So if you go into the concept with a 10% insurance position and you bought gold at $800 in 2008, and then in 2011, it's at $1,900. Your position of gold in your portfolio is probably not now 10%, it's probably 18%. You know, at any point between 2008 and 2011, as your gold position increases in percentage terms to your portfolio, you have to sell that portion off to bring it back to 10. Vice versa, if in 2011 you were caught up in the hype and you believed some of the pundits that said gold was going to $5,000 an ounce, your portfolio in 2014, when gold hit roughly 1,050, wasn't worth 10% anymore. It was probably worth 4%. At that point, you needed to buy 6% more to bring your insurance position back to 10. So when you do that, you've always got your protection in your portfolio, but then you're adding to your position when the market is weak, and you're selling your precious metals into strength, but always maintaining your 10% position.
Clearly, investors need to be cautious of the tendency to have wild expectations. And by having a more methodical, scientific method to the investing process, that allows you to have more consistent results. Makes good sense, and it's a better insurance policy overall. Let's talk about some of the other markets you're interested in and some of these other metals that we don't typically think of as precious metals. You've got your eye on a couple of interesting here.
Yeah, we looked at ruthenium approximately 2 years ago, it was trading just under $50. We looked at a long-term chart, and we saw that the high on ruthenium was about $350. We looked at the uses; it's primarily used in the electronics industry. We saw that the global, it appeared anyway at the time, and it certainly seems to have borne itself out that the global recovery was starting to generate some legs. So we suggested ruthenium at the $50 level had minimal downside risk. Today, I think it closed at $250. The metal that we really liked was rhodium. Back in 2016, we put a buyout at rhodium when it was at $700. It dipped a little lower than that. I think it got down to a low of $660. Today, rhodium's trading at $2,300. Rhodium, in our opinion, over the next 2 or 3 years has got considerable upside potential. I mean, it's a byproduct of platinum production. Platinum production has dropped severely now due because of some of the strikes in South Africa, but also because platinum is not used or will not be used as much going forward because it's primarily in the catalytic converters of diesel engines. And diesel engines are being phased out both in Europe, and we suspect they will also be phased out in China. The hybrid vehicles that are coming in tend to use more rhodium. There is considerably less rhodium on the market than there is platinum. It's a much, much more difficult metal to mine. So we think there is a squeeze coming in rhodium over the next 2 or 3 years, which could generate a move in rhodium from the current level to at least a double. It could go like it did in 2006 when it went to $10,000 an ounce. We're not that optimistic, but we think at the $2,200-$2,300 level, it's still a good intermediate to medium-term buy with our target somewhere around $4,000 over the next 18 months. And we've already picked up a return of almost $1,700 on the trade since we recommended in 2016.
Potential double, maybe put rhodium on the radar screen. I'd like to move on, though, to the concept of safety, of insurance for the portfolio. There are, economic situations which really requires that precious metals insurance plan, and they're learning that right now in real time playing out in Venezuela. The U.S. dollar, according to an article here from a major media source, is king in Caracas, Venezuela, hyperinflation approaching 1,000,000%. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not at some point, dollar hegemony may lose its strength, its safe haven qualities. And folks, even in North America, might be looking to the precious metals or the yellow metal as an alternative.
History certainly bears that out. I mean, going through a number of scenarios since gold became a free trading commodity back in late 72, early 73, there are times when gold acts as an extremely good hedge. And sometimes not only a hedge, but acts as an excellent investment given the circumstances at the time. What people are failing to understand is that gold does move in cycles. So when the Fed in 2008 through the 2011 sort of 12-ish area started to inflate the money supply by creating massive liquidity into the banking system to keep the banking system afloat, and it wasn't only the Fed, it was the ECB. It was the Japanese central bank. It was also the British central bank. In fact, pretty much every Western central bank in the world was generating massive liquidity, causing interest rates to go down to zero. That created a move into gold because the perception was that that would create inflation. In 2012, the Fed clearly signaled that they were now going to reverse policy, and they started to tighten monetary policy. And as they started to tighten monetary policy, the U.S. dollar got stronger. And as interest rate yields between the U.S. and its competitors, the ECB, started to widen in favor of the United States, you've got the 10-year U.S. Bond now at 3%. You've got the 10-year German Bund trading just south of about 1.2%. So those yields are still widening in favor of the dollar, creating flows into the dollar, into the U.S. stock market. And as a result, those headwinds are causing the commodity complex in general to weaken. We think that this trend is close to being over. We're not in the camp that believes the Fed is going to go another 4 or 5 times over the next 2 years. We think the Fed is probably going to maybe raise one more time, 2 at the outside. And then, if anything, I think in 2019, it's possible the Fed might either stay on hold or start to reverse course and start to weaken rates again, just as the Europeans now start to get into the cycle of tightening. Europeans are about 2 years behind the U.S. central bank in monetary policy. So now then, at that point, you're going to have the dollar weakening and money flowing back into the euro. and into other countries whose interest rate policies are now shifting to tightening as opposed to staying on an easing path. And that would be, in our opinion, the accelerant that will take gold up to, I'm not necessarily going to say new highs, but certainly get it up probably closer to the 14-1450 level than from where it is today at 1210.
Now, your analysis, I think, really parallels ours. Firstly, the Fed funds two more rate hikes likely this year, September, December, probably tapering off in 2019, we see as well. Kind of sets the stage, obviously, because as I'm sure you read last week, talking about their QE operations, wrapping that up, almost globally, we've seen the Fed's colleagues holding rates surprisingly and stubbornly low, even in negative territory. Moving on, there's some tensions with Iran. According to the Wall Street Journal today, they're hoarding gold, concerned about sanctions, obviously, from the United States, as are many nations around the world. Do you see any of the geopolitical tensions as a catalyst for higher precious metals prices?
Yeah, I can't say no to that question. I mean, there's obviously the possibility that goes off the rails between the U.S. and Iran. I mean, I don't see it, but the possibility exists, and as long as the tensions are there, that's going to create some kind of a floor to gold, at least from a geopolitical perspective. North Korea, again, I don't see anything actually happening from an actionable point of view. It could get tense again with North Korea, and that certainly is not going to be negative for the metals. If anything, it's going to create at least sort of a cushion floor where people are not going to be aggressively short the market and are going to be a little bit more sanguine in determining that they might want to hold some gold just in case. So again, I consider that a positive for gold. I think what the main catalyst for gold is going to be, though, is going to be more an economics type of play. If the Fed starts to ease again and the dollar comes under pressure, I think that's going to be positive for gold. Right now, it's still a question mark whether or not that 4.2% GDP growth in the second quarter is sustainable and whether the stock market at current levels is sustainable. So if we start seeing shifts there, or if the housing market comes under more pressure and it starts to put some pressure on the financial system, those are all positives for gold to move higher. What you would need to see for gold to really come under continued pressure from these levels would be a strong economy, geopolitical issues being sort of on the sidelines, and the Fed continuously aggressively raising rates without that being a detriment to the stock market. In that pictured scenario, I could see gold drifting down and maybe getting down to about 1150, 1120.
Obviously the economy did grow at 4.2%, and we also have, a tick down in the unemployment rate simultaneously to one of the lowest in quite some time. Investors' passion globally for U.S. equities is unabated, and that gives the Fed some wiggle room, but it could continue to put pressure, I think, on the safe haven assets and even commodities. Do you see a point where the metals play catch up with the CRB and crude oil?
If it translates into a consumer price index, that you'll notice that the Fed about three meetings ago started to change the language around inflation. At first, for the last three or four years, their target was employment rate, and they've surpassed that a year and a half ago, their target there. And then they had a 2% target on inflation.
And they've eclipsed that now.
They're almost using the rounding language. Well, this month it might be 2.3%, but, maybe in 2 months it'll be 1.8%. It should average out around 2%. So if it's sort of averaging out around 2%, maybe a little bit higher, we're not going to get too concerned. Whereas before, 2% was their line in the sand. So they're giving it some flexibility. There looks to me like they're going to allow inflation to run a little bit more aggressively before they really have to step on the gas and raise interest rates to curtail inflation. I think that's at least somewhat positive for the metals. Now, if inflation does get up to 2.5 and stays there and the Fed now takes this seriously and really starts to tighten, then I think there's going to be short-term pressure in the metals. But they're already getting pressure from the administration. I mean, just last week, Trump came out and basically almost scolded the Fed for raising rates because it was interfering with his economic progress. I mean, it's hurting the housing market with interest rates rising, and it potentially could be a headwind for the equity market. And I think the Trump administration sees that, so they've already started firing some shots over the bow, wanting the Fed to back away from their sort of stance of being more normalized in their rate structure. So that's something that's also worth watching. So if the Fed does back away, I think that's going to hurt the dollar, and I think that's going to be a catalyst to at least get a reasonable rally going in gold.
Obviously, much has been said about this potential trade war between the U.S. and its key trading partners, including Canada above, as well as China, Mexico, and Europe. A lot of blowback on this topic. It certainly hasn't impacted economic growth yet. We don't see any big boosts across the board in inflation, as you might expect. A tariff is essentially a tax, and it impacts almost every level of society.
If these tariffs go through, and I'm still not sure whether this is still just a bargaining chip or whether he's actually going to implement tariffs on $200 billion worth of imported goods from China. Again, I don't think he's thought this through. His base, I want to say this as generously as possible, but I would suggest his base is going to be the one that is the most hurt by this. If he is true to his word that his base is sort of the middle class to lower middle class, that's who he's trying to help and not the upper middle class, a rich category, which is really where he did help on the tax cuts. But on his base, most of these people, you know, don't have the luxury to shop at Tiffany's. You know, they shop at Walmart and they shop at stores that are reasonably priced. Well, if you go into any one of these stores, you'll see that 80-90% of the goods that are in those stores are manufactured in China. So you put a 25% tariff on there, that's going to increase the base cost of the most sort of the general necessities of life. And that, I think, is at that base level is going to increase the inflation rate, and that could have an impact on the metals. So I think when he thinks it all the way through, I'm not sure if he's using this as a negotiating posture or whether he's actually going to put these tariffs on. But if he does, I think it could have a significant slowing impact on the U.S. economy.
I mean, we are seeing some actual taxes, some actual tariffs play out. I mean, you know, our neighbors to the north, Canada, we're seeing an increase across the board for new homes here in the United States to the tune of 10 to 14% on building supplies, primarily lumber imported from Canada. One key example as to where, you know, middle America, really across the board, even the working class, will be paying more if they choose to purchase a new home. Any topicality you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
If you're not invested in the precious metals market, I mean, you know, don't buy gold because your neighbor tells you, or, you know, you go to a conference or something like that. Don't buy it for that reason, but until you at least educate yourself. I mean, again, I'm not trying to sort of promote the company that I work for, but it is a unique company in the sense that on our website, Kitco.com, we a lot of information on precious metals that it's given by a variety of analysts from both sides of the fence, bearish and bullish, that outline what their views are on the precious metals, outline various ways to buy and sell precious metals. So I think if you're going to get into precious metals for the first time as an investment, I do think you owe yourself at least to be educated and to understand the markets that you're getting into. So Kitco is a source for that, but there's various other sources out there that where you can get educated. But it is important to understand the investment.
And as we wrap up, any contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
Generally, I write a small little commentary every morning. It's not oriented towards the investor that is more medium to long-term in focus. It's more orientated towards the day trader that's looking for support resistance lines. And I try to give them sort of my sense of where I think the market is going to go that day. There's been days where there's really been nothing to say. I invite you to go and listen there and to read articles there if you're interested in learning, either my opinion or opinions of other analysts. If you're getting into more esoteric type of product, just the only cautionary note I'd like to give you, I mean, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium have huge liquidity. If you are starting to dip your toe into the more sort of esoteric metals like rhodium and ruthenium, just bear in mind that the spreads are a little wider and the volatility in those markets is usually considerably much more aggressive because the markets are thinner and there's not as many players in the market. So again, if you're getting into the more esoteric side of the market, make sure you're dealing with a dealer that gives you both a bid and an offer, not just an offer, and you understand what you're buying.
Look forward to hearing further thoughts in 2018.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Chris.
John Williams, head of ShadowStats.com, an alternative economic resource. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
How's the weather in that part of California today?
Well, it's sunny. Up in the San Francisco area, been having some storms recently, but it's a nice day today, and presumably that weather's going to be moving to the east.
That wasn't really a topic for today's discussion, but from what I'm reading through several sources, we're hearing that San Francisco might be peaking in its housing boom there, the echo bubble. Any quick comments there?
I think you're seeing that happening in a number of areas. The real estate market is not hasn't been as strong as it's been estimated. And if you look at the aggregate data, if you look at the existing home sales, the new home sales, housing starts, construction spending, you know, there's been some upward movement. If you smooth it out over 6 months, you're seeing basically a low level of stagnation. When I say low level, this is in contrast to where you were before the Great Recession. Generally, you're down, depending on the series, anywhere from 20 to 40% below the pre-recession peak, which is not exactly a fully recovered economy. In fact, the way the numbers generally are defined, if you look at the business cycle, a recession is when the economy starts to turn down from a what then becomes a pre-recession peak and falls till it hits a bottom and then starts to rise. The bottom is the trough, and then as it starts to rise, that's referred to as a recovery. But you really don't get an economic expansion, at least as economic expansion has been traditionally defined, until you recover above the pre-recession peak. So what you're seeing in the housing market is indeed there's been some recovery, but we haven't seen an expansion there in well over a decade, and you see it in other series such as the manufacturing sector. There you have now 123 months, a little over 10 years of non-economic expansion. And what's interesting with that is that it's the manufacturing series is part of industrial production, is it has a 100-year history behind it. And in the 100-year history of the series, you've never seen such a protracted period of non-economic expansion. This is going back to 1918, post-World War I. Now, the production headline production series has recovered, and that is due to an expanding expanding mining sector, particularly oil and gas drilling and extraction. But even there, with all the boom that's being reported in that area, industrial production is it's only a percent or so above its pre-recession peak. And if you follow the industrial production, it troughed and then it actually recovered and hit its prior peak at the end of 2014. You had a recovery of a couple of months, or an expansion of a couple of months, expansion of a full quarter, and then it turned down again. In the benchmark revisions that we saw last month, that recovery in 2000, that recovery or that brief recovery expansion remained intact. But what disappeared was the most recent numbers of industrial production had, after they'd fallen off there, had actually regained the 2014 level. That disappeared. That sank down. So that in that benchmark revision, you lost the recovery from what probably was a double dip recession, as they would formally look at it, but it was never defined as such. You've never had a protracted series of annual declines in industrial production and not been in formal recession except this period after 2014. Nonetheless, as it stands now in the revisions that were published this last week, production again has regained its level of at the end of 2014. But again, it's you're not seeing anything close to what's reported with the headline GDP, which I think is a very heavily gimmicked number. Right there, the GDP is up over 15% from its pre-recession peak, but I can't find a quality series that reflects anything close to that. Again, industrial production is, you know, maybe a percent or two. Manufacturing is down 5.4% from its pre-recession peak. All the housing numbers are down 10 to 20% from their peak. If you look at retail sales, which had a bad quarter, just contracted year to year after inflation, quarter to quarter after inflation. That series is overstated because when you look at an inflation adjusted number, what's key there is what kind of an inflation rate you use. The reason you use an inflation rate, if you look at your retail sales before adjusting for inflation, the nominal term as they call it, let's say that's up 5%. But if inflation were up 5%, then what that means is that all your sales gain was in inflation. You're not moving a higher volume of goods. So if you look at it net of inflation, you get an idea of the physical movement of goods if you're selling more goods. The way the government reports inflation, they understate inflation. They understate consumer inflation. And if you use too low a rate of inflation as they use here, that tends to overstate the real growth, the inflation-adjusted growth. But even so, you're not looking, you're maybe up 5 to 7% from pre-recession peak. You're not up 15%. I mean, that's the GDP, that's just nonsense. Adding to the good news, you have a widening trade deficit. That generally gets subtracted from GDP activity. So with everything that's happening here, even though the GDP growth is overstated, you're likely going to see a pretty good slowing in the growth rate for the first quarter of this year. That'll be announced next week. I think it could even be a contraction. Part of that's due to storm distortions that boosted fourth quarter activity. But when you get all the benchmark revisions in place, I think you're going to see that the first quarter GDP actually did contract and that we're probably in a new recession.
Let's shift over to the commodities sector. This has been uneventful, unfortunately, for many years amid the backdrop of an unfavorable global economic situation where essentially paper assets, let's just say in vogue and hard assets, lost the attention of the deep pockets and most investors. Well, that appears to be changing rapidly. We look at the commodities sector, the CRB is perking up. West Texas leading the charge, approaching $70 and probably much higher. We also see gold near multi-year highs, the XAU showing signs of life, and even silver topping 17 recently. We have a number we haven't seen in a long time.
Commodities do tend to move. Certain commodities, such as oil, will tend to move with economic activity. But that's also a commodity because of how it's produced globally that's very sensitive to the value of the dollar. And what you've been seeing there is that the Fed has artificially propped the dollar in recent years. That's beginning to fall apart. And as the dollar weakens, you see stronger oil prices. That is a there's an inverse relationship there that's a long range correlation of about 80%. So generally, as the dollar weakens, oil in particular rises, and oil is and its derivative products are primary generators of our domestic inflation. So that as the dollar weakens and the oil prices rise, you should start to see some pickup in our headline inflation. And my contention is you're going to see got good risk of a dollar panic here as the Fed continues to run into trouble. They still haven't been able to bring the system under adequate control following the near banking collapse in 2028. And that is, as the economy weakens here, I think we're going to move back towards the quantitative easing, and that in turn will clobber the dollar, spike commodity prices, such as oil, that move contrary to the dollar, and with domestic inflation on the rise, be very bullish for the precious metals, gold and silver, which are your best hedges long-term for preserving the purchasing power of your wealth and assets. So, yeah, I've seen generally a market here that's going to become very bullish for gold and silver, but it's in the context of bad news of higher inflation for the people in the United States.
The threat of a trade war with China, a lot of saber rattling, the administration very upset with them, and then suddenly we find out that most of those trade tariffs were really smoke and mirrors is really what it amounted to. I mean, obviously China, our number one trading partner, but we don't want to do too much to upset the apple cart. Give us an idea of how these tariffs might impact, especially the domestic economy.
anything that will raise the cost of the imports will tend to be inflationary. But you have a circumstance where the, indeed, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and huffing and puffing here. Trade deficit is a very serious problem. We've got a good shot here in the next week of seeing the worst quarterly trade deficit net of inflation that that's ever been seen. Generally, it's bad news for the dollar. It's bad news for the economy. It reflects a lot of economic loss of jobs offshore, production offshore, wealth offshore. It's one reason that the electorate was disgruntled at the time of the last presidential election and helped President Trump get elected. I think he's indeed looking at addressing that trade area. We've had terrible trade deals, and people have had all sorts of motives for putting them in place. Whether they're going to be meaningfully addressed remains to be seen. I don't think anyone's going to collapse the global economy over it. I think that what's going back and forth is largely negotiation. You'll get some deals that'll improve the circumstance a little bit. To the extent there's tariffs, again, that adds to inflation. But consider, this is just something that doesn't really have a happy solution for everyone as to how you look at it. But one reason that we have this problem is that the cost of producing goods and doing business in the United States is so expensive. I mean, if you look at the, putting aside for a moment just our cost of labor, all the benefits, all the safety features that have to be in production, all the product liability issues that arise for people who manufacture goods here, the insurance costs, benefits costs, the health costs, they're extremely high. They're beneficial for the, what the problem is, your products lose their competitiveness in the world markets. I'll give you an example. I used to have a company that manufactured abrasive wheels in Michigan. We had a product liability issue there where somebody got injured with a grinding wheel that they claimed we had made. They couldn't show that it was made by us. The insurance company handled the case, and I was a little naive at the time, but they settled it. They gave a fellow $20,000 for having lost his salt. He dropped the product. He couldn't show that it was our product. Nonetheless, they settled. But then they canceled our insurance. The cost of replacing that insurance took it from something like 0.07 of a percent of our sales to 7% of our sales. I mean, it put us out of business. It's very difficult to compete manufacturing in the U.S. environment against the rest of the world where you have such low labor costs, low cost in terms of the benefits for the workers, a lot of protection against the liability suits in the United States is if you want to get a product made in the United States on a competitive basis with, let's say, an Asian country, which doesn't have all the environmental standards, work standards, and such that we have. One way of trying to put things on a parallel basis is with a tariff. The point there is say, hey, look, we've decided this is the way we want our world to be. We want workers to be treated in a good manner. We want products to be safe and for companies to take liability for things that they make mistakes on. And if you want to change your environment so that you're on parallel with us, then, the tariff's not needed. But as long as we're competing in this environment, we need a tariff. There's an inequality there in the global system where the decisions that have been made by the U.S. government, legislative bodies and courts and such have said, this is what's correct, this is what we need, but it becomes uncompetitive when you try to trade in the rest of the world. So how do you balance that out? And that's, again, at this point in time, it would be tariffs.
The Federal Reserve meeting comments late last Wednesday seemed quite hawkish relative to earlier comments. I mean, there's concerns over the growth that you alluded to and higher prices, i.e. inflation. Obviously, we're going to have much higher rates. This will have a detrimental impact on many areas of the economy, especially, of course, housing. You have a huge component of the economic recovery clearly in the housing sector, and the Fed funds futures now are alluding to a couple more rate hikes at least. This should put rates, it looks like, in the neighborhood of 3.75% and higher in the next year or so. Give us your idea on just how this might impact the markets as well as the economy, please.
The higher rates indeed are not good for the housing market. As I mentioned earlier, the housing market still hasn't recovered. The banking system hasn't recovered. the Fed has never been able to work out its system since it bailed out the banks and literally bailed out the system, preventing an economic collapse. Although we did have something pretty close to an economic collapse, it was not quite as bad as it could have been. They guaranteed all deposits. They bailed out whatever had to be bailed out. They bailed out General Motors. The Fed purchased AIG, which is the world's largest insurance company, that was providing insurance on these bad mortgage-backed securities that were bringing the banking system down. They flooded the system with liquidity, but they wouldn't let the banks lend it out into the economy, which might have helped the economy. The deposit, the cash you're getting from the Fed back with the Fed, and the Fed paid the bank's interest. It's never been stabilized. They haven't worked it out, and that's still a problem around the world. And one thing that we saw in the recession that we had and the economic weakness, stagnation that I contend we have now, they've never been able to bring the system under control. They sacrificed economic growth to preserve the banking system. They probably should have scrapped the banking system and restructured that, and you might have had a basis for positive growth going forward. But until this all works out, and I think it doesn't work out without a major crash in the system, you're not going to get normal economic growth as people are used to it.
Be remiss if I didn't mention U.S. equities. Obviously, volatility has increased markedly. We've seen the VIX and the VIX derivative surprisingly high levels, which has been extremely detrimental to the short volatility trade, which was really the go-to money maker for many years. Well, that backfired in a huge way, blowing up several funds and ETFs in the process. It all seemed to begin with that U.K. construction firm, which imploded and was the number one short company all throughout Europe. They've proven now, the hedge funds and the institutions recognize that even the powers that be knew that it was doomed. Do you believe that we've seen the peak?
Oh, that's tough to well overvalued and don't see it having a happy ending. I think what the proximal trigger will be a misstep by the Fed trying to prop up the banking system further as the economy weakens. What they have to watch out for, and you're beginning to see it, and it's also affecting the pricing of oil and gold, is weakness in the dollar. If you get a massive sell-off in the dollar, and I think that'll be the proximal trigger, that'll also reflect a flight of foreign capital from the U.S. equity markets as well as the credit markets, which would tend to push rates higher. But as the capital comes out of the stock market, that'll be reflected in heavy selling. That's what gave us a crash in 1987. That was a misstep. We had a very weak dollar at the time. We'd been propping it up. Here the Fed's been taking actions to prop it up as well, at least in jawboning interest rates. Coming into that weekend before the crash in 87, James Baker's then Treasury Secretary made a comment to the effect that the U.S. is no longer going to support the dollar against the Deutsche Mark. I'd been in trading currencies for a while and knew that was going to give you a massive sell-off in the dollar, which happened. And with that, the capital also fled from the stock market. And I think that's a type of circumstance you're going to see here. You have a lot of foreign capital in the markets here. As that leaves the U.S., there's enough of it to be the balance between holding the market where it is and a plunge. And I think this is going to end in some kind of a selling panic, both of the dollar and of the U.S. stocks, and the flight generally would be to the hard assets such as gold.
Now there is an alternative for the BRICS nations in particular. China launches what some folks are referring to as the death knell for the petrol arrangement. Gold-backed yuan oil contract trading heavily and with the full support of the PBOC. So give us your idea on the significance of this new exchange, whether or not this will have a major impact or if you see it as merely an anomaly.
Well, it certainly could have it certainly can have major impact. I mean, the yuan is now a reserve currency, but its relative volume in the markets is still small. That can change rapidly, but I'd watch. I mean, if you see the volume of it growing in the markets, then what you're looking at there would be a major threat to the dollar. Long term, that may be a case here, but I think we're going to have the panic here triggered for more standard things before that comes into play.
And lastly, really should mention the potential impact of the crypto revolution On global currencies, I mean, obviously right now, relative to the multi-trillion dollar daily currency markets, and then of course maybe, you know, we're looking at hundreds of trillions if you add the currency, stock, and bond markets together. Are you a proponent or at least a believer that this revolution, Bitcoin and others, will pose a threat to the fiat money system? People will, within 5 years or less, they'll be looking for cryptocurrencies instead.
I'd be surprised if you see that in that time frame. I mean, down the road, there are any number of things that are going to happen, and I can't tell you that I can give you a really meaningful prediction at this point in time. I would be very cautious there. I view the cryptocurrencies as like playing at a casino. You want to put some money in it, that's fine, but don't bet more than you can afford to lose. Frankly, I prefer physical gold. It has a traditional value there that's been established over thousands of years, and it's not subject to destruction by an electromagnetic pulse.
So you're sticking with your well-established thesis that we will see maybe Venezuela-style inflation that takes a little more than a year or so to unfold. I mean, obviously that country has been, and in Argentina, their neighbor, have been plagued with these inflationary bouts now for decades. It just seems to be a reoccurring theme. We haven't seen anything like that in 150 years. Could that be the event that catches our policymakers off guard? And how would you see that unfold in the next few years if it were to happen?
Again, you're looking at something there that's tied to the dollar. The rest of the world decides it doesn't want to have its money in the dollar, which could happen with a misstep by the Fed. And the Fed has made missteps in the past. And things are not in balance. They don't know how to get things into balance now. So anything they try may backfire. The dollar would be the proximal trigger there again. Flight from the dollar, you'd see a big spike in oil prices, domestic inflation. If you look at the headline inflation of the last couple of years, it's been basically a matter of gasoline prices. It'll go far beyond that. But as the dollar weakens, people don't want to hold the dollar. You'll see eventually a very massive spike in inflation here. It can develop quickly. The government itself is long-term bankrupt. I mean, there's no way they can honor their long-range obligations here that now in terms of net present value of what they should have in cash today to cover everything they've said they're going to pay out to people in the way of Social Security and Medicare. So it's over $100 trillion. That's five times the size of our economy. It's 50% larger than the global economy. It just can't possibly be covered. So one of two things have to happen. Either they have to, and I'm talking now the U.S. government, has to take action to bring the system into solvent balance, or you're going to end up with what Alan Greenspan had suggested at the time of the downgrading U.S. debt a couple of years ago. He said, well, you know, there's no risk of U.S. defaulting on its debt here because all its debt is in dollars, and we print dollars, and we can print as many dollars as we need to. Well, that's inflation. That's the way the world ends here, unless the politicians in Washington can find a way of bringing this under control. And you look at what's happened there the last couple of years, and even in the last couple of months, there's no indication there that there's anyone looking to seriously restore long-range solvency for the U.S. government. So ultimately, you know, you're going to end up with a worthless dollar. That's another word for inflation. Gold and silver are your primary hedges against that. They'll preserve the purchasing power of your assets over time.
Don't you suspect that they will just have a Monday morning revaluation? Suddenly find out that if you had 10,000 in the savings account or banking account, they're going to lop off a digit and you have 1,000.
They can do that, but it doesn't just a matter of redenominating the way you have prices. It doesn't really, I mean, by the time you're doing that, you've already lost the purchasing power. Let me put it this way. You had $100 back in 1900 before the Fed was founded. If you bought $100 in gold, you'd still have your $100. If you just left your money in dollars and didn't invest it otherwise, get interest on it, which in theory would tend to cover inflation, you'd be looking at something like 20 cents left on your $100 today. That's how much inflation we've had in the last 120 years. And it's not much different if you look at it the last 100 years. Most of it's happened since the founding of the Fed, but the greatest part happened after Roosevelt abandoned the domestic gold standard back in the 30s. The reason he did that was he needed more money to try and pull the economy out of the Great Depression. But in doing that, he also created a lot of inflation. And so we've got a fiat currency doomed to inflation with it over time. It's just a matter of how quick. We've been buying time with the dollar here. I watch the dollar as that goes in the global markets. You'll also see its purchasing power sink very rapidly here, meaning higher inflation.
We appreciate your thoughts, and we'd like for you to tell people more about the ShadowStats website and all the great services you're providing, please.
So I have a website, shadowstats.com. I provide a weekly newsletter. It's available to subscribers. They can download it from the site. But there's also a lot of information on the site that gives you background on a great deal of what we've talked about here today. That's free to anyone who wants to look at the site. You'll see articles over on the right-hand side. Left-hand side, you see the headlines from recent newsletters back several months. Those are all open to the public. We're always happy to have new subscribers. It's $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. If you've got any questions, you can find a way of contacting me on the website. Happy to communicate with you.
John Williams, thanks so much for making time for us today. Talk soon.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Sometimes you just have to speak up.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com Radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
Or non-disclosure agreements involving former models, White House staffers,
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
On the part of most journalists when they discuss these documents as they relate to these high-profile cases, because they know a large number of people in their audience will never have need to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And therefore, journalists imply a level of mystery, intrigue, and cavalier behavior around these documents that are patently false. Parties enter into NDAs for a variety of reasons: to review information for a business transaction, to keep something secret after the fact, or to shut down and silence bogus and fraudulent allegations. There are many levels of enforcement that can exist in an NDA. Most have basic enforcement provisions that facilitate everyday business transactions and are often quite benign. However, as you move up the food chain in terms of complexity and the kind of information that is to remain confidential, these documents can be packed with clauses and stipulations in which you sign away your rights, your property, or your freedom in advance if you violate them. These can include financial penalties, loss of assets, and in some instances, your freedom. When people tell you, either out of naivete or deliberate misinformation, that large-scale secrets or conspiracies cannot happen because someone, somewhere, would certainly say something, think again. Secrets are kept every day and for very long periods of time. Most every major journalist that reports news is under their own non-disclosure agreement. Some extremely sensitive non-disclosure agreements are never distributed to the signer. They are kept under lock and key in the bowels of the law firm that created them, available to be reviewed only in person. And in some cases, the signer can never acknowledge the existence of the agreement itself. Imagine being asked, persuaded, or forced to sign such a document that you can never have a copy of, have limited or restricted access to review, and can never acknowledge the existence of. When you see the news media sensationalize defiant people who have disregarded non-disclosure agreements they lawfully entered into, whether those people are former models, White House staffers, or heads of various agencies, understand those individuals are already in serious trouble. And regardless of the politically expedient rhetoric that seems to give these individuals a pass, make no mistake, consequences await down the road. When the media lights have dimmed or gone dark, and those who would encourage such individuals to skirt or flagrantly violate the law are no longer by their side to egg them on or protect them. The law has a sneaky way of catching up with people. We can only hope. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.